What up, world? It's your boy E letting you know we are now proud members of the Visionaries Global Media family. That's right, catch us Wednesdays on Visionaries Global Media.
Welcome to Visionaries Global Media, your number one source for podcasting entertainment. Visionaries Global Media, envisioning excellence on a global scale.
This is Nattering with E with your host, Eric Friedlander.
What up, world? It's your boy E coming at you from the Nattering with E studios. Today, we are finally talking about wrestling. After looking at the 80s, the 90s, our favorite things of the provinces, and books with SJ and Brendan, I'm flying solo as I am joined today by the owner of Junction City Wrestling in Toronto. Toronto's one of the best cities in the world for independent wrestling, and I've been fortunate enough to connect with Freedom Wallace from Junction City Wrestling. As I just noted, he's the owner of Junction City, but he's also an arch nemesis of my main man, Space Monkey. So, Mr. Freedom, when do you think you and Space will get a singles match together?
Oh, my goodness. So he's your main man, so that might make you and I arch nemesis as well. I've wrestled Space Monkey countless times. I've had one singles match with him. You can find that on YouTube, along with all of the other existing Junction City Wrestling episodes. I believe that happened in season 5 on YouTube. It would have been September of 2021, but I'm always up for punching the monkey in the face at any possible opportunity. I most recently wrestled Space Monkey this past September, and my cousin Bradford Montague and I sadly and unfortunately lost the Junction City Wrestling Tag Team Championship to the newly formed team, the intergalactic interspecies duo of Space Monkey and the adventurer Stone Rockwell, together known as Space Adventure.
I was actually at that card with a couple of mutual friends of ours, Dan Ricci, shout out to him. And it was the first time I'd seen Junction City, and I was so intrigued by it because for years growing up, I was like, when I would go to wrestling, it would always be a WWE event. So now in my 30s, being like so into indie wrestling, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing that there's more than just WWE or like the big shows, you know, there's the independents. So how did you get started first in independent wrestling and second, starting your own promotion?
Oh, a long story. So where to start? So I loved wrestling growing up, and all I ever knew was WWF as well. Like, I wasn't familiar with an independent scene. So we go back to, say, 2011, 2012. In 2011, I was DJing a lot, and I'd always wanted to put on my own wrestling events. And this probably can be traced back to even playing with wrestling action figures. And I would write out cards and keep track of their win-loss records and string together narrative storylines for my toys. And I can remember getting in trouble in grade 8 in school for like organizing like pro wrestling, like just off school property, which was really just like coercing other 12 and 13 year olds to semi fight each other. So 2011, I was DJing a lot. I was doing like wrestling themed DJ dance party nights, even one of which was called Dance-a-Mania, and crafted a logo, obviously ripping off the WrestleMania logo. 2012, a friend of mine was promoting events at a place called the Rock Pile, which is on the west side of the city, Kipling and Dundas. And the wrestling organization Death Proof Fight Club booked a show or were booked into the Rock Pile. So this promoter friend of mine knew that I loved wrestling, and they were putting on not only Death Proof Wrestling, but also having rock bands in between the wrestling matches, and they wanted to have a DJ at the show. So I got booked as the DJ for this Death Proof Fight Club event. Then my friend put me in contact with the Death Proof promoter, who is Warhead. And so we connected, and I said, look, I love wrestling. Love to be more a part of this show than just the DJ. And obviously when you're the DJ at a wrestling show, I'm the guy who's also playing the entrance music for all the wrestlers. Anyway, one thing led to another, and I was allowed to be the referee of the main event of the Death Proof Fight Club wrestling show. So I was like the special guest referee. So they had thrown me on the poster as well. It's like DJ, my name's Andrew McRae. My last name is McRae. So I was DJ MC Ray. So they threw me on the poster, MC Ray. And it's like me in sunglasses and headphones, and I had a toy WWF championship belt. And he never wound up showing up, but Just Incredible was supposed to be on this show as well. And Death Proof, completely opposite of Junction City Wrestling, but is a like basically a rated R, in some cases, instances, X-rated wrestling promotion. So I'm on this poster, look like a complete dweeb. If I were a wrestler, especially probably a death match style wrestler, and saw me on that poster, I would be targeting myself as somebody to teach a lesson to on the night of that event. But there I am, DJ MC Ray, sunglasses, toy championship belt, Just Incredible, like a stripper, like a glass tube getting broken over somebody else's head. It's a ridiculous sight. So I still have that poster. So that was the first event, and I got to referee the main event. And of course, there are no rules in deathmatch wrestling, really. So I just kind of followed the action around. But they gave me my own entrance as the special guest referee, and I like came out to a song I had produced myself. Anyway, at that time, that was like, I thought that was great. That was pretty cool. So that was my first experience actually being in a show, in an independent wrestling show. 2012 carried on. I did a lot more of that through 2012 and 2013 for not only Death Proof, but another promotion called Victory Commonwealth Wrestling. I fulfilled every role, from, referee. I was always the DJ or sound guy, but then would also referee. I got to be a ring announcer. I got to fill in little bit roles here and there and play whatever roles they had available. I started training in 2013. And this is all a long story, and I could go on forever, but just quickly about the start of actually physically starting to wrestle. So that first Death Proof show was May of 2012. It was Warhead who suggested I start going to training to learn first how to become a better referee. So I first went to a class in March of 2013 at Squared Circle Training to basically learn how to be a referee. Wound up doing some of the pro wrestling training. Went back in the June for 4 classes, basically just fully immersed myself in the wrestling training. And then Battle Arts Academy opened in the September of 2013. And I walked in there the day it opened and was the first student to sign up for their pro wrestling program. So that's how I first got into indie wrestling and then progressed to actually training to become a wrestler.
That's awesome. Had you been to like indie shows prior to being the DJ, like as a fan, I mean?
No, this was my first exposure to it. Like I knew they existed. I think I had heard about, it was probably the Apocalypse Wrestling Federation that ran Medieval Times. So that's Ron Hutchinson's promotion. Like I heard about that happening, and I would see the wrestling at the exhibition when I was a kid. So I knew there was some kind of underground independent wrestling out there. But no, I never used to go to shows. I can remember like in probably the, I don't know, late 90s, like probably around the same time I was making kids wrestle each other in the schoolyard. I think I looked on the internet to see like what 80s wrestlers are out there that are like accepting bookings. Where can you find that on the internet? And for some reason, I have a vague memory of like coming across like Cousin Luke. He was like one of the obscure hillbillies that was paired up with Hillbilly Jim in the mid 80s. Like he was available for bookings at the time. I think I saw that Honky Tonk Man was out there. It could have booked Honky Tonk Man in like 1998 or 1999. So the thought was always in the back of my mind of like, I wonder if I could put on a wrestling show. And then from the time of starting to train in wrestling, so this is September 2013, the first Junction City show didn't take place until July of 2017. So, and there's a story behind that as well, but you're the host. I'll let you go back and do some talking and ask me some questions.
So one question I have for you, I guess like the typical interview question you get is like, who was the wrestler that inspired you to get into wrestling, and who's your favorite wrestler currently?
The wrestler that inspired me to get into wrestling is an interesting question because it probably isn't like I don't think I modeled myself after anyone I saw in the WWF. Like when I got into wrestling, I don't think I imagined myself to be a wrestler. So that, I mean, I hesitate to, but I feel like I have to say it was Santino Marella or Anthony Carelli because he was my coach at Battle Arts. And I think honestly, he made me believe that I was capable of more than I would have otherwise thought. So, credit to him for that. My favorite wrestler, though, of all time is Bret the Hitman Hart. And then I love Owen Hart and Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, and Rowdy Roddy Piper, and the list goes on and on and on. And it depends on what year and time period we're talking about, and whether or not I was 5 years old, or whether I was 10 years old, or my favorites would change. But Bret Hart, hands down, anybody asks me who's my favorite wrestler, it'll always be Bret Hart. But I didn't model myself after Bret Hart necessarily. I mean, as time has gone on, I think I've borrowed elements from all kinds of different wrestlers that I grew up watching. And to be honest, I still have imposter syndrome. Like I don't, you know, it's I can get in there and do some damage, but I don't I still have a hard time sometimes believing that I'm a capable wrestler. But obviously I am. My championship track record speaks for itself.
That's fair. That's fair. Okay, so I know it. So up until now, we've been talking about just your background, who your favorite wrestler is, things of that nature. However, you said something that interested me, more than all of that. All of that interested me for sure. But the thing that interested me the most was that you said that Bret Hart was your favorite wrestler. Now, we're going to end up debating for the next. You said you can only go for an hour when we were off air, but this may end up being like a 6 hour conversation now because the
Don't tell
both.
me Shawn Michaels is your favorite wrestler.
No, incorrect. I was a
Okay.
big Lex Luger guy back in the day. So
Interesting.
I'm convinced that Bret had too big of an ego to allow Lex Luger to not only win the 1994 Royal Rumble, but then beat Yokozuna and go on to have like a WWF wrestling heavyweight title run back in 94.
Well, I have yet to meet such a Lex Luger supporter. This is a new one for me, in fact. So you're asking whether I think Bret Hart prevented Lex Luger from having the run that he deserved?
100%, 100%. Because we always hear like things coming out now about the clique and different guys. Like Hogan never did the job to anybody in WCW, for instance, right? And when Brett went into WCW and was supposed to fight DDP or any of the like faces when he was a heel, he always had someone else do his dirty work, and he never wanted to do the job. Even I might go as far as to say, and I hope you do come back on the podcast. Like we're just talking here, just strictly. I should preface it with that, but Brett should have dropped the title to Lex Luger sooner. That way, the Montreal Screwjob never would have happened. I'm going as far as to say that.
So we're just talking alternate reality, yeah, exactly. Different timeline would have changed the course of history. I mean, if it would have perhaps prevented that, I don't know what kind of a person would I be if I didn't have the childhood trauma of the Montreal Screwjob. It would have changed the course of history for everyone. We probably wouldn't be sitting here.
Who knows? You could have been a Lex fan too.
I remember Lex Luger arriving in the WWF quite well. And if I dig deep and try to relate to my childhood self at 6 years old at the time, I think it would happen too fast. And he, like, and I was six, you know, so I wasn't like watching diligently every single week, week in, week out. It just felt like all of a sudden he went from the highly unlikable narcissist. They did the Stars and Stripes gimmick where he body slammed Yokozuna on the carrier ship. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden he was riding on the Lex Express and was the big baby face. Whereas, I don't know, there was a buildup for Bret Hart. There was time to get behind Bret Hart. I don't know. I really only started watching as Bret was coming up. Like I'm the perfect Bret Hart fan. Like to start tuning in 1992, and he's Intercontinental Champion, and he has the match with Piper at WrestleMania, and then the next thing you know, he is the world champion. But I was also renting the tapes, and I have a cousin who's 10 years older, and he lived one floor above me in the apartment building I grew up in. And I often say it's his fault that I'm a wrestling fan, because he had all the big rubber LJNs. He would rent all the tapes. And from an early age, like I was renting tapes from Video 99 in the Crossways Mall at Dundas and Bloor, across from Dundas West Subway Station. So, you know, in 1992, I was watching WrestleMania 4 from 1988 and seeing the Battle Royal that opens WrestleMania 4. I've probably seen that match more than any other match in wrestling history, because I rented that tape so many times. And it's a 4-hour event. Most often it's just you're throwing on a wrestling tape, pick WrestleMania 4 because it's your favorite. You get through the Battle Royal, partway through Jim Duggan versus DiBiase, and then something else happens and you stop watching. But that Battle Royal at the start of WrestleMania 4, you know, where Bad News Brown double crosses Bret Hart and Bret Hart destroys the trophy. Mm-hmm. Like that's like a formative childhood memory. And then another one is like the Hart Foundation. Like I know they were heels in the earlier 80s, but I used to rent SummerSlam 90 a lot as well. And there's the 2 out of 3 falls match with Demolition, where Hart Foundation wins the tag titles back. Like that's a formative childhood memory of Bret Hart. And the Rowdy Piper Bret Hart match to start WrestleMania 8. Like I love both those guys. And that's a formative Bret Hart memory. And those just weren't there for Lex Luger. So like he came on the scene and he was the heel and he was the narcissist. And the first WrestleMania I watched as it happened was WrestleMania 9. And I remember being upset that he beat Mr. Perfect that night, Lex Luger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I remember not really understanding, like I was as surprised as everyone else at 6 years old when Hogan came away from that with the championship and Brett lost to Yoko. And then the next thing, you know, the next year, it's like, who does the crowd like more, Bret Hart or Lex Luger? So for me as a kid, when I think back, I don't think Luger had a fair chance. Did Bret Hart ruin Lex Luger's chance at becoming the champion because of a political move or his ego? Maybe, probably. But I, unfortunately, in the world of professional wrestling, like, it's a strength to be able to convince the person that decides who's going to win that you should win. If you can convince them that you're the guy, then you're the guy. That's part of the competition, actually, is like relationship building and playing the game, for lack of better phrase.
Yeah, it's like,
so you could be right, but it doesn't make me any more of a Lex Luger fan.
Oh no, fair enough. Fair enough. it's sort of like survival of the fittest, right? Because you're trying to, like, everybody wants to be at the top. The thing that never sat right with me to this day, and so you're born in 88 as well? Or
born in 86.
86? Oh, okay, yeah, I'm born in 88. Yeah. So a couple years behind you. But it never sat right with me that I think Brett comes in at like 22 at Rumble 94, and he's injured because he fought Owen earlier in the night, and Owen like wrecked his knee. And instead of just tossing him out, like anybody, like logic would say, this is the weakest guy, throw him out of the ring. Lex Luger literally stands in front and like defends him the entire time till they're the final two. And then they both go over in a tie, which I'm convinced Brett actually touched the ground first, not Lex. And they just, this is an audio only podcast, but if you could see Freedom's face right now, he's just like, F this guy.
No, I think it's funny that it, like, when people talk 90s wrestling, like, you're the first person who's cared this much about Lex Luger. It's just it's a new experience for me. I remember that Royal Rumble well. I remember that. And I haven't watched it in ages. So yeah, like, I don't think back on that and think about how Luger was protecting him. But now that you mention it, yeah, it's always struck me as a lackluster finish. I didn't like that as a kid. Mm-hmm. That they both went over at the same time. I don't know who touched first, really, but just in from an entertainment standpoint, I never really liked that Royal Rumble. That wasn't one that I would go back to and repeatedly watch. It's just a non-finish.
Yeah. What bothered me about it is that, like, as you noted, Lex had so much momentum going in there. Like, his face, he body slams Yokozuna, becomes a face, and like he's sort of like LA Knight currently, where he had all this momentum and then he faced in Lex's case Yokozuna, and then in LA Knight's version Roman Reigns. And you're like, there's no way. On the one hand, you're like, this is amazing, he's got like a ton of steam and stuff, but is it way too early to put the title on him? As you noted, maybe it was. I personally think Lex could have done like, he could have carried the company, because in a couple years after that, you're seeing like Paul and Nash go and form the NWO in WCW. Brett eventually leaves, but like, and then Lex eventually goes to WCW too, but he just becomes like a guy. He doesn't become the franchise player that maybe they should have allowed him to be.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't Luger wrestle Yoko at SummerSlam 93 for the title?
Let me look that up for real.
And Yoko had just, so if that's the case, Yoko would have just beaten Hogan for the title at King of the Ring, and likely his first title defense. But I think that was the first, like, they put that title match out there.
Yeah.
Lex, I don't know.
Lex beats Yoko by count out. For
lame.
That. Yeah.
And how does he lose at WrestleMania?
WrestleMania, I think Yokozuna just pins him clean.
Yoko pins Lex Luger at WrestleMania 10?
Yeah, because if you recall, they had to have, instead of just making it a triple threat between Lex, Brett, and Yokozuna, they decided to do each of the challengers would have like a match first. And then, so I think they flip a coin, if memory serves. They flip a coin. Lex gets to face Yokozuna first. And then if he wins, right. And then if he wins, he goes on and takes on Brett in a one-on-one match.
He would defend against Brett, right, yeah, but he doesn't. And Perfect was the referee.
Right, right. So that's
wrestling. Who a year prior had wrestled Luger at WrestleMania.
Yeah, so revenge, basically. WrestleMania.
Well, the number one thing about WrestleMania 10 that stands out to me is the opening match. I know a lot of people will call out the ladder match between Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon, but as you had seen, I don't think I showed it the night you were there, no. But I'd be remiss not to mention the Retro Wrestling Watch Along, which is co-presented by Junction City Wrestling and the venue within which it takes place, which is the Shacklands Brewing Co. Tap Room. And this is a monthly event where we curate a selection of professional wrestling matches from as far back as the 1960s, but predominantly from the time I grew up watching. So early 90s, late 80s, as far as 1997, with my cutoff being the Montreal Screwjob, because that's when it all changes for me. But I showed the opener on one of the recent editions of the Retro Wrestling Watch Along between Bret Hart and Owen Hart. And that is like, that's a match that if I was showing somebody wrestling that's never watched wrestling ever, that'd be on the short list of matches where I'd be like, this is the first wrestling match you need to see ever. This is your introduction to professional wrestling. And that is like opening up a can of worms, because there's so many ways you could think about, well, what kind of a match would you want to show somebody that's never watched wrestling before? What if you were showing an alien from outer space, like this is going to be their introduction to professional wrestling on Earth. In fact, I'm going to ask you a question. What would you show an alien from outer space as the very first professional wrestling match they've ever seen? They have no prior knowledge of what professional wrestling is. Opportunity to show them it for the very first time in the known universe. What match are you showing that alien?
You know what? I'm so glad that you asked me that. Like, I've wanted someone to ask me this for so long because I have an answer for it. I just have to double check if I get the names correct. But it's actually a women's match from like the 1997, I think it was. What's the name of it? It's Aja Kong versus Toyota? Tonoma? Something like that. Aja Kong.
Interesting. Hang on. Where did it take place?
Aja Kong versus Manami Toyota. Manami Toyota. It took place. Okay, so there's two versions of this. One, it's considered by many to be probably the greatest women's wrestling match of all time, which is it was in the WWA. And it took place on, I can send you the link in a second, actually.
Well, this sounds like the perfect match to screen at the next Retro Wrestling Watch Along. Unless yeah, it's like an hour, unless it's an hour and a half
32
long.
It's 32 minutes, so I don't know if you'd want to. It was from June 27th, 1995. Dave Meltzer, who his rating scale for Wrestling Observer is basically anything the Young Bucks and anything Will Ospreay does is a 5-star match. So he gave this a 5-star match as well. And it's considered by many to be one of the greatest like women's matches of all time. What I would say too, in terms of like a men's match, the the best match to me of all time is probably Bret versus Stone Cold. The double turn.
Yep.
Double turn at WrestleMania 13.
I know, yeah, I just said that's an awesome match.
I know I just said that that I'm anti Bret, but like that was what got me into being like a big Stone Cold fan, was that double turn. That was like, it was like chef's kiss, you know? So that's another one that I would
show. 1997 heel Bret. I know off the top, just before you hit record, you asked me if I watch hockey and if I'm a hockey fan and if I like the Leafs. And sadly, yes, I'm a diehard Maple Leafs fan. And I, you know, I shouldn't have to apologize for it, but it's just such a controversial topic. Surely there are people who would hear that and think, now they just don't want to listen to me anymore because they like the Leafs. But I love the Leafs. And 1997, Bret Hart and the Hart Foundation story, like, I cared as much about them winning as I do and did about the Leafs winning or the Blue Jays winning. Like, it was, it probably meant more. Like, when Hart Foundation won the July pay-per-view, the 10-man tag, the Calgary Stampede gimmick, that was a big deal. And obviously it was a crushing defeat when the screw job happened. Like, I never got over it. I'm not over it.
I have a stupid, well, I don't know if it's a stupid question. I mean, it's my podcast, so whatever question, it's all good either way. But my question was this, like, I get that McMahon was the booker and everything for Survivor Series and like WWF at the time, but like, why didn't did Bret like already by that point, because I can't recall, I think I was more into WCW at the time, but had Bret gone away from Owen and the rest of the Hart Foundation? Like, why didn't they get involved, I guess, is my question.
So, no, they hadn't split. It was fizzling out a bit, but no, they were still very much the Hart Foundation. Why they didn't get involved was probably because they were all under the impression that the finish wasn't going to be what it wound up being. I think they all got duped. And I haven't seen it in ages, but I think the stories told in the documentary that was produced, Wrestling with Shadows, and Davey Boy and Owen are definitely in the building and there. And there is a match that night. And yeah, I think like it kind of had lost its luster. The peak was probably July, like the Calgary Stampede 10-man tag. Then they go on to SummerSlam. Owen Hart drops Stone Cold on his head and there's the neck injury. So surely that didn't help Owen's cause. I think Davey Boy lost to Ken Shamrock, kind of got buried in like a lose and eat dog food match or something. Oh, right, stupid, yes. Like that.
Yeah.
And then Brian Pillman dies in the October. So that sucked. Because they went into like, I'm trying to think back. So SummerSlam, then there was in the September of 97, there was the pay-per-view Ground Zero. And they had brought in the Patriot, and Bret Hart was wrestling the Patriot. And the main event was Michaels and Undertaker. And then the next month was the first Hell in a Cell, and it was Michaels and Undertaker again. And on that October show, it was Bret Hart and Bulldog against Patriot and Vader. And then on Survivor Series, I feel like Bulldog and Anvil like teamed up with Doug Furness and Philip LaFon.
Oh, right. Yes.
Those guys. And I think Owen wrestled Austin again. Like, I feel like that's when Austin came back, was the Survivor Series, but I could be wrong. But yeah, those were dark days. And then I remember the months that followed, like they brought Jim the Anvil Neidhart. They trotted him out on a Raw and they did the thing where he like, they faked out him joining D-Generation X, and then Hunter and Sean turned on Anvil. And then, of course, Owen came back and worked the program with Michaels and ultimately winds up wrestling Triple H at WrestleMania and losing. Nothing was ever the same. But no, to answer your not stupid question, the Hart Foundation were still together. And yeah, I imagine they didn't think that the screw job was going to happen either. So
yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. That whole thing was crazy because, as you said, I can't, well, this sort of sounds like trolling, but okay, it is trolling. I was going to say, if Lex had just won in 1994, none of this happens, man. None of this happens.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's an interesting, you could do an entire podcast around the alternate reality of what if Lex Luger had become champion. And like, there's a blog to be written about that. People would click on that. Like, those exist. There's all like,
want to come on that podcast? Like, we could do that.
I mean, we kind of are.
Yeah.
Well, let's start it. What do you think? What would have changed about? Okay, so you think Luger should have won the Royal Rumble and won the championship in 1994?
Exactly.
All right. So, like, who challenges Lex Luger throughout 1994 as a heel for the WWF title?
So to me, the no pun intended, but the right guy is Mr. Perfect, because I just looked it up now that Mr. Perfect disqualifies Luger. So, and then Yokozuna carries on and goes and loses to Brett in at WrestleMania 10. Had Perfect not screwed Luger, this whole conspiracy around Luger, maybe he's like carrying the company for a few years, and then he's not eventually going to be in Sting's shadow and things like that. So
interesting. Well, because Luger doesn't last long after 94. Like, he forms a team with Bulldog, and they're the Allied Powers.
Yeah.
So Luger and Bulldog wrestle at WrestleMania 11. But then Luger shows up, like, well, I feel like he was still on a Raw. There was like a couple matches in the can for on Raw. Like, they taped 4 weeks or something. And then within that 4 weeks, Luger left and showed up on Nitro. I think on the first Nitro, if I'm not mistaken, in that mall in Minneapolis. Okay, so that's interesting, because Perfect never wrestled again in WWF after 1993, and was obviously, well, he did, but you know, way down the line in 2002.
Yeah.
But those, that would have been an interesting thing to have Perfect wrestle again in 94, 95, 96 WWF.
Yeah, that I would agree with for sure. Yeah, Luger versus Perfect, I think, makes so much sense given the whole disqualification at WrestleMania 10, plus the match in the previous year, WrestleMania 9. There's also, I mean, Yokozuna, of course, is the obvious one for who he could have also feuded with, until Yokozuna unfortunately passed away. I'm just,
well,
looking,
how long ahead. Do you think Lex Luger's on top here?
Probably. Okay, if he wins the title at Mania 10, I'd say he holds it till SummerSlam that year, probably.
And who does he lose it to?
I gotta look at SummerSlam 93. Sorry, I have this up on another screen.
It's okay. I mean, Shawn Michaels is certainly waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
And coming up as a heel.
Was Hall hadn't left for WCW by then, had he?
No, Razor Ramon was still there.
So that would have been another one. If they, because as you know as well, they usually have like the face wins the title, and then as his run progresses, or her run progresses, they eventually turn heel because the fans get tired of them having the title for so long. So I wonder, so in that light, I wonder if he could have feuded with like a face Razor Ramon at the time.
You think Luke, do you think the fans would have?
I think
they there's an interesting one that almost is like halfway between an alternate reality and the truth, because I think the fan base themselves were not convinced. I don't know that it was all a Bret Hart power move. I feel like Vince had a beat on what the fans really were looking for, and I don't think the whole audience was convinced and behind Luger. So had Luger won, perhaps there would have been fans who didn't like that, and he might not have been like he might not have had the whole audience behind him.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a world in which he wins it as a babyface and winds up immediately heel again.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'd agree with that too, because correct me if I'm wrong, but this feels like such a letdown to me in the regard that not only does he get disqualified and screwed by Mr. Perfect at WrestleMania 10, Lex Luger, but then he ends up losing to Tatanka at SummerSlam 94. Like, come on. Like, he just went from this major, major program like 6 months earlier. And now he's losing to Tatanka. Like,
Luger lost to Tatanka, eh?
Tatanka at WrestleMania, I mean at SummerSlam 94.
Yeah, and I wasn't paying very close attention at that time. So did Tatanka go heel and join DiBiase by that point? Is that what happened?
I think so.
That must have been, because Tatanka turned heel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably what happened, from what I can tell from this Wikipedia thing.
They cut it. I think there was somebody cut his feathers off. I recall that. And then he joined Ted DiBiase. Do you remember when they brought back Nikolai Volkoff in like 1994 and DiBiase was his manager?
Yeah.
And Nikolai was wearing tights that had the cent sign on them instead of the dollar sign.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was like a brief, strange mid-90s Nikolai Volkoff babyface run.
I vaguely remember that.
I mean, that just came back to me now. That was buried deep in my subconscious. Perhaps that's another piece that I should break out for the retro wrestling watch along, the next of which is of course happening on Wednesday, April 17th at 7 p.m. inside Shacklands Brewing Co. Completely free to attend. So what do we got? It was Aja Kong and Toyota. Okay. And that's a 32-minute match from the WWA.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's the match you say it is, and it's the match that you would show to an alien as the first thing that you would ever show them as an introduction to professional wrestling, I think it's worth a screening. And I might need to find a clip of Nikolai Volkoff in scent tights as well.
There was do you remember that? Okay, I think it was WCW where Sting, they were trying to get Sting over as champion, and he was feuding with Rick Rude, and then Rick Rude like literally beat the crap out of him, and Rick Rude's stable also joined in and beat the crap out of Sting, and then I think it was Nikolai Volkoff came to Sting's rescue.
That one evades me. I was not I did not watch a lot of WCW in the early to mid 90s. None, in fact. My first exposure really to WCW, like, I knew it existed. Mm-hmm. I can remember as a kid, my aforementioned cousin who was 10 years older. Like, I remember when Ric Flair came to the WWF in 1992. That was like my first indicator that there was any other wrestling other than the WWF. Like, I remember knowing that Ric Flair came from the other place. That was about it. And then growing up, I didn't have, like, my family didn't spring for the premium cable package. So we didn't have TBS or WGN or any of the channels that you could get WCW on at that time. So it wasn't until it was like readily available on TSN, like when Nitro was blowing up. Like it probably wasn't easy to find until probably 96, and I probably didn't start watching it till 97. And in 97, I almost certainly was. Like I know I was. And I would, because then at that point I was a fanatic, taking in any wrestling I could. I would listen to the pay-per-views, literally listen to the pay-per-views because they would be scrambled because we weren't paying for viewer's choice. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the proper box to even be able to buy the viewer's choice.
Yep.
So, but you could get to the viewer's choice channel. So I would listen to scrambled pay-per-views. And I can remember there was a hotline in the yellow pages for rumors, and you would call this hotline, like flip through the yellow pages to the sports section, find this phone number, and you could call in. I don't remember what it was called, but it was like four options, and it was like a minute and a half recording of some guy like citing off rumors of things that may or may not happen soon. Like, watch out for this guy might show up from WWF to WCW soon and things like that. Yeah, I was all over it.
That's awesome, man. How did you get into like actually owning your own promotion?
So again, you can trace that back to childhood, but the origin story of Junction City Wrestling is through credit is due to Shacklands Brewing Co., where we host this retro wrestling watch along. So the thought was in mind. I had already gone and visited a couple of venues with another local wrestler by the name of Buck Gunderson, who was around when I started my journey through Death Proof Fight Club. And Buck Gunderson was the promoter of Victory Commonwealth Wrestling. So he was also my first opponent. So Buck Gunderson, to be fair, has a lot to do with me getting into wrestling in the first place. And before I started physically training, when Buck was running VCW, he and I went and scouted out a couple of venues, one of which where I had already DJed prior was 3030 Dundas West, where I now is one of the venues where I hold Junction City Wrestling events. But I digress. So fast forward to 2016, been training at Battle Arts for close 3 years, and Anthony Santino at Battle Arts, I suppose somebody had reached out to him, and they were from the Trenton area, about an hour and a half, 2 hours east of here, and wanted to bring wrestling to Trenton. And this would have been the fall of late summer, fall of 2016. And actually, just prior to that, I was definitely already thinking about it, because I now remember, as I'm telling you this story, I had visited a curling club in Brighton and looked into booking it for a professional wrestling show. So Brighton is a town not too far from Trenton, and my sister has a cottage out that way. So I was there often in the summer. So anyway, I'd visited a curling club and taken it as far as like pitching some dates and looking into the insurance and figuring out what it would entail to actually pull this off. That didn't work out, but lo and behold, like a couple months later or less, somebody from the area connected with Battle Arts about having a wrestling show out that way. So we wound up putting on a Battle Arts Academy wrestling show in a parking lot outside of a brewery. So that's the important piece. Mm. So I was the guy driving the truck. You know, Santino basically like put me in charge of the logistics and operations side of making this thing happen, taking the sound equipment. I went out and visited I did like a, what you would call a site inspection. I drove to Trenton myself, went to the brewery, met the brewery guys, met the guy who'd been dealing with Anthony, did a media thing, like did like an arm wrestling match with like a teenage girl on their morning news.
Did you do the job or did she?
Oh yeah. No, I lost. Yeah. did the whole thing. So I was basically in charge of putting this together, and this was basically the pilot project for what would become Junction City Wrestling, long story short. But it involved everything. Like, we took the ring from Battle Arts Academy, took it down, loaded into a truck. I drove like a 26-foot Penske truck from Mississauga to Trenton, set it up, promoted it. I made the posters. We drew a crowd. We got the local radio station involved. And it was outside of a brewery. And it was a relative success, I suppose. And got out of there, took the ring back, took the truck back, set the ring back up. All that's involved in doing a road show. So this was October of 2016. And that was kind of my first experience with pretty much producing an event myself with a little bit of help. And all the while, our monthly student shows at Battle Arts, I also had a hand in the production. Like, I would make sure everybody's music was on the computer. I'd be the one making sure the computer's connected to the projection screen and everybody's entrance videos are going to play. I'd be the one figuring out what light sequence are we going to play for everybody's entrance. I'd set up the hard cam, arrange for there to be a ringside camera person, come record the commentators, come away with all that footage. Edit the matches for fun. Like, I was there as a student. I didn't have to do it. Nobody asked me to do it. I wanted to do it. And then we would review the shows every month, the student shows. So I was already fully immersed in producing through my educational experience at Battle Arts. So prior to that, I'm at the time living west side of the city, not too far from Shacklands Brewing Co. So we're talking Keel and St. Clair ish. And there's a pair of breweries back there. One of them opened first in like late 2015. And I had already walked over there actually in late 2015, spoken to the owners of the neighboring brewery, which is called Reinhard Brewing Co. Mm-hmm. Spoken to them and at least mentioned it to them and was like, have you ever thought of having wrestling in the parking lot? And they, you know, it didn't go anywhere. So beginning of 2017, Shacklands Brewing Co. opened up right next to Reinhard. They're side by side and they share a parking lot. So I approached Dave Watts, who owns Shacklands, in the April, probably on like my second time ever being in there. And I was sitting there and he had a wall of memorabilia behind him from all walks of life and every weird interest and niche you can imagine was up there. And among all the memorabilia was a Brutus the Barber Beefcake collector glass. And I saw that on the shelf and I took that as my in. And I said, I see you have a Brutus the Barber Beefcake collector glass on the shelf. Have you ever thought about having professional wrestling in the parking lot? And as Dave would tell the story, he's like, the answer to your first question is no, but the answer to your next question is yes. And that would have been April of 2017. Basically, he was like, yeah, let's do it. And like, aside from my prior experience, I had no idea how to put on a wrestling event. I know how to put on a wrestling event, but now I'm out in the wild basically. So it's like, okay, all right. So I guess we're booking this parking lot and there's a lot that goes into it, you know, like there's a lot you have to organize and arrange to make it work. But anyway, we made it work. So the very first Junction City Wrestling show took place in July of 2017. The date evades me, but we did a second one in August of 2017. And then we did a third one in October of 2017. And all three of those were free to attend. And they were at, you know, for what it was at the time, relatively successful. We got a local charitable organization on board. So the Hockey Association for the Developmentally Challenged a team specifically, actually. So the Gladiators of the Hockey Association for the Developmentally Challenged, they were kind enough. For those first few events, the wrestlers got paid in like tax donation receipts. So the charitable organization issued all the wrestlers a donation receipt for their time, which then, of course, they could put in through their tax return and claim them as a charitable donation. That's where it started. Free to attend events in the parking lot. I believe the first two we did rent the ring from Squared Circle, but the third one we took the ring down at Battle Arts and brought the ring ourselves. And yeah, did those three in the first year. And then the next year we came back, did two more, July of 2018, October of 2018. And then there's a third brewery there in that pocket on the next lot. And so in the 1920s, the building itself was a garbage incinerator. And it's this big, beautiful Art Deco building that while we were doing the initial shows in 2017 and 2018, somebody had bought it and sunk a gazillion dollars into it and started restoring it. So by, in 2017, if you watch the initial episodes of Junction City Wrestling, it's still like a dilapidated, beat up building and with nothing going on. And by 2018, they're starting to renovate it. Mid 2018, I think that it probably opened around that time. And a third brewery went in there. So that was Junction Craft Brewery. And in mid 2018, I approached them. So January of 2019, we graduated to an indoor ticketed event inside Junction Craft Brewery. So that was the progression. It was, I approached Dave. He said yes. We did five free events outside in the parking lot with just Shacklands on board. Reinhardt didn't have any, the neighboring brewery didn't have anything to do with those first five. Now they're officially a partner and I work with both of them. But in those first 2 years, it was just Shacklands and then got into Junction Craft in the January of 2019. But yeah, it was just something I always wanted to do, and just it literally can be traced back to my affinity for playing with action figures and writing the stories myself and deciding what happens. Not even about like who's winning or losing, but in anything I do, I love drawing an emotional response from whoever's watching.
That's awesome. That's a fantastic story, man. It's like the Canadian dream, you could say, like building up, like it's a blue collar, hardworking story, from
I was thinking that like this past weekend, like we just had a show. And it's like, I think in coming up in training, like I experienced some crazy things that I never imagined I would. Like I wrestled a match in the WWE. And like I said off the top, I think to his credit, Anthony Corelli or Santino Marella like pushed me and made me believe more in myself than I otherwise would have, and allowed me, or rather, created the opportunities and, pushed me in such a way that allowed me to have the opportunities to do things I'd never thought I would. And in some regards, probably like made me think my dream was something that maybe it wasn't. Because I don't imagine myself to be, well, it's probably too late now, but I don't actually imagine myself to be a full-time WWE wrestler. I don't think that's what I actually want to do. I love getting in the ring. Don't get me wrong. I love being able to wrestle. But I love producing these events and like bringing a local audience that keeps coming back time and time again. And yeah, I feel like what I experienced this past Sunday and what I experienced at a Junction City wrestling show, like that's the dream. If you would tell 5-year-old me that that's what I'd get to do, that's the dream. That's what I always wanted to do. So I think I'm doing it. I feel like I'm living the dream.
So that's fantastic. But my question to end this is, would you give Space Monkey the Bret Hart Survivor Series 97 treatment, or would, or do you think you'll ever be pals?
Well, in all honesty, because, you know, if this is pretty honest, I'm having an honest conversation with you, and, you know, we're at the moment, I'm also working on, there's a side project that's happening simultaneously along with the Junction City Wrestling events. And I have this idea, and I'm producing a mockumentary film. And Space Monkey's in it. And within the world we're building in this mockumentary film, wrestling is real. Like Space Monkey is from space in this mockumentary. And there's a difference between, and Space Monkey wouldn't want me to say this, but like, who are we kidding? So the Space Monkey is a really nice monkey. in all reality, I actually really like Space Monkey. So despite our differences in the ring that we've had, and the handful of battles that Freedom Wallace and Space Monkey have had, Space Monkey's actually awesome. So no, I wouldn't give Space Monkey the Bret Hart treatment. That might happen to him. I might write that into a show at some point. But personally, I wouldn't do that to Space Monkey.
Fair enough.
As a character, for the sake of drawing a reaction from the audience that's paying attention to the story that we're telling, maybe.
Fair enough. Well, before we get out of here, let the fine people of the internet know where they can find you and plug your stuff.
So. All right. So, I mean, if you want to find me specifically, you can do a Google search for Freedom Wallace. But if you do that, you're going to get a whole bunch of images of Mel Gibson in Braveheart, actually. So you might want to Google search Freedom Wallace wrestler. My Instagram handle is Freedom is McRae, McRae. But likely more importantly, you should follow Junction City Wrestling, where you can find Junction City Wrestling at Junction City Wrestling on Instagram. JunctionCityWrestling.com, of course, is a place where it'll drive you to all the other pages we have on the internet. We're on TikTok and YouTube and Facebook, and there's all kinds of content there we've been building since 2017. So there are 6 seasons of Junction City Wrestling episodes on YouTube you can go back and watch, and then a handful of other specials that have been produced as well. And of course, if you want to see Junction City Wrestling live, which is the real deal, which is what everybody should aspire to do, our next event is on Sunday, May 5th at 3 p.m. inside 3030 Dundas West. And then I'll drop this news. This is a worldwide exclusive piece of breaking news just for Nattering with E, just for the Nattering with E audience. Our next show after Sunday, May 5th, which of course is aptly titled May the 5th Be With You, will take place on Sunday, June 16th, back in the parking lot outside of Shacklands Brewing Co. and Reinhardt Brewing Co., where it all began. So May 5th, 3030 Dundas West, June 16th, Shacklands Brewing Co. and Reinhardt Brewing Co. Tickets and information are available at junctioncitywrestling.com and through the link in our bio on our Instagram profile.
That is awesome, man. That is great. And as always, you can catch me at E_Freeds on Twitter. I refuse to call it X because all my X's are my X.
plural?
X plural. I don't know. I'm just a knucklehead. I'm just a knucklehead here for the ride, man. And you can catch us on Instagram too at Nattering with E, all one word. This will go up probably tomorrow. We're recording on a Wednesday, but this will go up on a Thursday on Nattering with E, and also with our boys from the US, Visionaries Global Media, which we just recently, it's been about 5 weeks of collaborating, and they put our stuff out on Apple Music because we won't be denied. And yeah, this is great. Also, you can catch me at the May 5th show as well. So I'll be the one telling Space Monkey all the nice things that Freedom Wallace has been talking about on this podcast. And also, I'll try and get to the one on June 16th as well. So yeah, Freedom, Andrew, a pleasure, man. I hope you come back on the show, and maybe eventually you'll be wearing a Lex Luger t-shirt to the ring.
Well, anything's possible. You should have seen what I wore on Sunday. It's different than the usual get-up with the kilt.
Nice. Well, yeah, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Eric.
See you, people.